My name is Essie, and I am a resiliency coach. I'm so happy to share my share with Pierre today on Conversation with Pierre.
Hey, everybody, it's Pearl Sharenza with Women's Successful Living, and you are on with another of Conversations with Pearl today. And I am so excited because, as many of you who follow and listen to us, it's not often that we get to have an amazing gentleman on our show. And today is no exception. So I am so excited to welcome on the show today, Essie Bagheri. He is a survivor in every sense of the world. As a child soldier and refugee, he faced unspeakable horrors that no one should ever have to endure. Essie's struggles continued as he battled addiction and trauma. And today he is a recovering addict, author, podcaster, TEDx speaker, and advocate for mental health and wellness. Through his own journey of healing and growth, Essie has gained the knowledge and expertise to help others overcome their own challenges and find hope in the darkest moments. Essie is an inspiring public speaker who has dedicated his life to helping others overcome trauma and addiction. From his childhood in pre-revolution Iran to serving as a boy soldier in the Revolutionary Guard, Essie's journey has been one of resilience, strength, and hope. After struggling with addiction and trauma himself, Essie has emerged as a powerful voice and advocate for mental health, personality development, and transformation. He has authored the book Shattered Soul, which tells his powerful story of redemption, recovery, and self-forgiveness. Today, Essie offers public speaking to help others heal from their own trauma and addiction and shine and find the light in their own darkest moments. If you're ready to transform your life, check out Essie's website and a call to learn more about his other life-changing speaking topics. And we're going to share all that as well in our show notes. And I want you to be sure to watch Essie's inspiring TED Talk, The Silence of Trauma and Addiction, Confession of a Child Soldier, where he shares the story of overcoming adversity and finding hope, as well as his thriving podcast titled Resiliency Talks. Essie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, Pierre.
I'm so excited to have you here. And you know, it's you know, today when we're recording this, those that are listening, we're in the middle of some really unfortunate times going on in our world with over in Israel and everything that's happening. And when I was thinking about you coming on the show, I thought about those young children, those young soldiers that are in the same place you were back then. And I know right now this is probably, you know, some hard reminders for what you've gone through in your life. And I just want to thank you for coming and sharing your story with our listeners, but also putting your story out in the world. Because, you know, often when I coach women, especially of a nonprofit that I coach for women that are transitioning between homelessness, I remind them, and you and I both know Michelle Jewsbury, we remind everybody, our story matters and our story can change somebody's life. And I'm sure right now your story is probably touching many people throughout the world with what's happening today. So Essie, share with us your story. Give us a little background of, you know, what brought you to what you're doing today, and how, and maybe touch on what's happening in the world a little bit, on how, you know, I'm sure there's been some triggers there for you over the past couple of weeks.
Oh, definitely, definitely. First of all, it's I'm very heartbroken regarding what's going on in Middle East in both sides, you know, I can attest to the devastation that war and killing each other can happen to not just, you know, we are in North America, you know, we see what we see on TV, but we really don't see the impact that would had on like in my case, in my life, the things that happened, it's impacted my whole life. And so I pray that for peace, I pray that people start to come in to their sense and stop this what's going on in Middle East. As you know, yes, I, you know, originally I'm from Iran, and you know, I grew up in a family of loving family. They did the best they could, but unfortunately, you know, it was after the revolution that I got into the, because that's all I knew. I got into I trained to as of age of 14 to go to war and train to kill, and that's not a place for a 14 years old to be. And I saw unfortunate and devastating impact of the war. And so I'm all about peace today, and we go through my story more in details.
Yeah, thank you so much for touching on that. And, you know, for everybody that's listening, if you have family or friends or anybody, just know that we are sending and lifting up prayers from our show for some peace to happen for everybody all around. And so, Etsy, you're right. I mean, at 14, I was thinking, gosh, 14 years old, you know, what was I doing at 14? I started babysitting because I wanted to have some income to go to the mall. Never in, you know, like you said, in our minds to think that a 14-year-old is going to go to war, you know, and all the things that come along with when you're at war. And so, you know, for us, like how, tell us a little bit about how long were you, and, you know, give us a little bit, walk through your story. You know, you're 14, you're in, you know, in the army, you're in, you know, at war. Tell us like how that, you know, how that impacts your life. And then also talk to us, like what changed, how were you able to escape that? And then lead us, and then we'll talk more about how it led to the other things, the trauma that it brought on in your life.
For sure. I believe the childhood trauma is real. And there's a lot of talk regarding trauma and childhood trauma, but the impact that has on us. So in my case, I was separated from my mom when I was like 6 months old. At age of five, I find out I have two mothers. So that was like trauma from very young age. Before age of nine, I was mentally, emotionally, and sexually abused. And so I was already kind of damaged in very, very childhood. And then when I was 13, it was the revolution got, I was actually Iraq attack Iran, and I was just a kid. And in 1980, as I said, the war started, and I was like, I don't know what happened at the time, but I, like everybody here, the people talking about, oh, let's go to college, let's do this. Like me and my friends, we were talking about, okay, let's go to war, not knowing the what's happening. It was like we seen all these dead people coming from war, and we got like very emotional, and I wanted to protect my my country. And somehow at that age, I didn't have the ability. So what happened was I joined Revolutionary Guard in Iran, and I went and I got trained for 6 months. And while I was, you know, it was really, you know, I don't believe that a 14 years old boy has any right to be in that environment. And while I'm it was at the middle of the night at 2 a.m. and we were going to dismantle landmines, me and a bunch of my friends, like 13, 14, 15. And while I was, they were in front of me, the two close friends of mine, they step on, there was like a chemical weapon pouring from the sky. There was bullets whistling past my ears. And two of my friends in front of me, Pierre, step in a landmine, and they blow to pieces. And the impact of that trauma, impact of explosion, threw me a few meters away, and I became conscious, and I didn't want to die. My child, my boy, my childhood thing came. So what is this? And the reality hits. And that's where I was delusional, and I couldn't go back and say, I'm sorry, I changed my mind. I'm just a kid. And I couldn't go to step on another landmine. So one thing came to my mind. I don't know. It was a divine, it was something, but I had to take ultimate action, ultimate sacrifice. So I took my AK-47 and I put it in my left arm at age of 14, and I shot myself. And so that's basically when I thought, oh, I'm going to be safe. But that's just the beginning. That's the beginning of my life, my journey.
Wow. And, you know, like when you're sitting here, you're saying, I'm like going, I can't imagine at 14, like watch, first of all, you watch your friends, what happened to your friends. It's just so traumatic. And then going, you're right. You can't go back to people and be like, I don't want to be here because, you know, what that result's going to be. And how do I get myself out of this? And so in your mind, at such a young, immature 14 year old, you're thinking the only thing I can think to do is to shoot myself, you know, and do something to stop this madness that's happening in my life right now. And you know, I think about, you know, here in America, we see these stories of these young kids, like, you know, 14 getting these guns and things like that. And you just go, you know, what's happening, you know, in their minds, because that's such a young age to make such an adult decision, right? Mm-hmm. And for you to have to make that, to be catapulted into an adult decision to say, I need to change something now because I don't want to be like my friends. I want to be here. I want to, you know, and that trauma that it brought. So after that happened, what happened? Like, what was the next step that happened for you? And kind of walk us through like that, I don't think you ever recover from it, but that journey of, you know, trying to be resilient as you share. And I know that, let's talk about how that led to your other trauma, the addictions and things like that as well.
Of course. So after I shot myself, I thought I'm going to be, they took me back and, you know, my physical wound healed after like 3 months. I had 93 stitches in my arm, 93 stitches, and everything, my physical wound healed. But I had no idea, Pierre, that the impact of psychological impact on, I had no clue. So I was full of shame, guilt, remorse, and then at the age of 15, like after I went back home, my cousin and my family, part of my family, they were drinking. And so one night I was in their house, like I was living this double life. Part of me was like Revolutionary Guard. Alcohol was against Islam and a new regime. And part of my other side, I have this family that they've been drinking, using drugs. So they offered me a drink pill and I was hesitated, but I took it. But something happened after I took that drink. It's like I find my medicine, because it just ease all my worry. I couldn't stand in my skin another minute. And after I took that drink, it's like I find the magic. And I loved alcohol because it really kills the pain. And then I start using opium. And then and it was like I was medicating. And so that's what happened. And then I got into the forced marriage because my family see that, oh, I see, I was really dysfunctional, obviously with what I've been through. But they said, okay, to calm him down, let's give him a wife. So they gave me another girl, and I got into the forced marriage. And as a result, I had two beautiful sons, which I'm proud of them. But at the time, so what happened? I went to Syria, Damascus, for the prayer. Everybody said, Essie, you better get out of Iran for a couple of weeks. And then, so I went with the government. I went there, and then I went and I took a, I still experienced that sense of ease and comfort, which I took a drink and I really needed that, but it was against Islam. So I saw a bar prayer, and I told myself, I told everybody, I went to pray, and I said, I'm sick. I made excuse. I told myself, I'm going to go to this bar. I'm just going to have two drinks. By the time they come back, I'm going to be sober. I had no idea. I went to this bar and I got drunk, and I started having fight with bartender, waitress. They sent me to the police station pier, and I couldn't speak Arabic. So they had to bring someone from the hotel. They said, which hotel? So they brought the person who was in charge, which was one of our Revolutionary Guard mentor, and they saw me that I'm drunk. And it was a big, you know. So they sent me back to Iran. They don't want to. Anyways, I had a friend that he says, Essie, you have to get out of here because this is a big no. At the time, it was very strict. And so in a week, I escaped from Iran to Istanbul. And I was from Istanbul, I escaped and I went to East Germany from East Germany, middle of the night, I jumped in a train and I went to West Germany and I became refugee and in a refugee camp for 2.5 years. And that by itself, it was a completely different story.
I was sitting here. I've been taking notes while we're talking. So for the listeners, if you're not taking notes, take notes. And if for those that are listening, if you feel like any of this has been a trigger for you, you know, please make sure you reach out to those resources for help. Essie, so I want to go back to childhood trauma for a moment, because you're right that childhood trauma plays so much. And first, often, sometimes we, you know, I remember I was coaching my group coaching. We have a group that meets every Sunday evening from 8 to 9 p.m. It's called our Shiro League. And at one point we were trying to do the inner child work and everybody's like, I had a great childhood, or I don't have any issues with my child. But as we started digging into it, they couldn't handle it. So we actually had to stop it because they really were not open to receiving what we were learning. Right. But this past past couple of weeks, you and I were talking before we came on that I've been really busy and traveling and things. And one of the things I was doing was trying to go help my mom with a move to the goal, was she was going to live with me and my brother kind of part time. And so I got some things happen. I have an uncle who tries to be very involved and has not seen her in 7 or 8 years and has been trying to influence health decisions for her, which are damaging to her health, and was making some threats. And I'm all about, when I coach, about setting boundaries, what's good for your self-care, you know. And I went back to my boundaries and I was like, I have these boundaries, Mom. I love you, but I have to put these boundaries around, you know. So I came home and I was talking with a fellow coach. And she was saying, Pearl, as I went through, I was like, and it was such an eye opening. And as a coach, I mean, you're a coach, I'm a coach, you know, we need coaches, but sometimes even as a coach, we can see, we don't see the bigger picture, right? We don't want to step into it. And she reminded me that, you know, my parents got married very young. My mom was 17, had me before she even turned 19, you know, 10 months later, you know, here's this baby. And, you know, my dad's going off to war in Vietnam and she's stuck home with this baby, which she didn't want to have a baby at the time. And then she's watching all her friends go out, have a great time. And she's stuck with this baby. And I was like, oh my gosh. Cause my husband, I've been with my husband 40 years. And he used to say, ever since I've been around you, Pearl, your mom's had like this resentment towards you. And I'm like, yeah, I could never figure it out. And when I talked with my friend Juanita last week, I was like, that so makes sense now, right? It was that aha moment. So childhood trauma has so much to play in our actions. And then, like you said, in our emotional decisions, like you made an emotional decision to go off to, you know, be in the guard. And so, you know, and then that emotional decision to shoot yourself because you want to stop that pain. You don't want to go in that pain. But then as you talk about it, you know, you healed fit from the wound, you know, physically, but that psychological impact, you know, we want something to help us take the pain away, right? Which we talked about, you know, addictions, like you talked about the alcohol. And it's interesting, I was working with a young man we're mentoring, and his comment to me last week was, well, when I drink alcohol, I can see things clearly. And I had a conversation going, do you understand where that's challenged? You're not allowing yourself to feel the pain of what is happening, or allow yourself to face the fear, the reality of a choice you have to make, right? So we numb down the pain, like you were saying, and then it goes into other decisions, you know, that we accept in our lives that are not necessarily healthy for us. And, you know, I wrote down escaping, like you were escaping. I feel like everything you said, you've been escaping, right? For me, it's like that's that word that sticks out, to the point that you even had a friend that said, Essie, that drinking you did is really bad, against the rules, not followed. You need to escape. So you are still escaping into getting away from getting in trouble, or whatever the ramifications could be for your decision that you make emotionally, right?
Yes.
And so you've gone, now you've gone off, you've escaped, you've become a refugee over in Germany. And so what led you to your next decision in your life? Like, what was that next part? Path decision, because you came to the US at some point, right? And so welcome
Canada.
So welcome to those other decisions
for sure. While I was in West Germany, I experienced a lot of racism, and then I did not take a sober breath. In all my conversation that I do, I always have to emphasize the impact of, because drinking and using drug was the solution for me. Some people, they don't understand why, because I would have killed myself many times if it wasn't for alcohol and drugs, because to medicate. So I came after 2.5 years, I escaped from Germany and I bought a false passport, and it's a Jose Antonio Gracie or something with my picture on it. And I came and escaped, came to Canada in 1988. And since then, and I really, here's this very important things that we could, we talk about it in a trauma and addiction coaching, that geographical change. If we move from one place to another place, we're going to be different, or if we feel, but nothing going to change. Guess what? I'm taking myself everywhere I go. So, and then, so when I came to Canada, 1988, I really had the intention to change my life, but I had no idea about the trauma. I had no idea about my addiction, that I'm not well. And so since then, I started working, and my drinking for 6 months was manageable, you know, because fear, new country, but then it went out of hand again. And then I came to Vancouver, Canada, 1993, and really I could not stand my skin, and no amount of drinking and drugging would help. We talked about it in our coaching thing, that I passed through a well-known stage. Like I could not, invisible line. Doesn't matter what I put, I still. So what happened? I had this girlfriend, and I'm living in this house, this basement suite. I've been drinking and drugging and wanted to kill myself. And in 1997, and she came to me and said, "See, I can't do this anymore. You better get help." I said, "What should I do?" And she said, "I don't know." And she just closed the door, slammed the door. And so I picked up the phone and I called the operator. And I said, "I have problem." My English wasn't that good either at the time. I said, "I have problem with alcohol and drugs, and I don't know what to do." And she says, "No worry, hon. I give you a detox number." I said, "What's detox?" She said, "You will find out." So I thought, honestly, I thought they're going to take me to hospital, because what's happening, when I was a baby, my mom used to say, when you were crying, she would put opium in my milk to calm me down. And they were laughing about it when I was like a little older. And it was like, to them, it was funny. So I thought they're going to take me to hospital. They're going to do a blood transfusion and I will be okay. Honestly, that's what I thought. I had no idea that, hello, there's something going on in center of my mind. And then that was my first treatment center. Long story short, because of the timing, I've been to 17 treatment centers, 29 detoxes, psych ward, homelessness, and until almost 10 years ago. I mean, my 10 years of sobriety now, almost 10 years. I mean, I just missed my son's wedding, and my sister called me, said, "Essie, you haven't been a dad to your son. Why don't you come and for his wedding?" I said, "I can't, sister. I'm not well." And I'm not going to go to details what happened, but that night I felt so, I bought the ticket, I packed my bag 3 hours before my flight. I mean, I'm living in this, she sent me some money because I didn't have, she sent me some money. I bought, and then 3 hours before my flight, I told myself, because I was nervous, I said, "I'm going to take a couple sip of drink," and guess what happened? That couple sip of drink put me in a situation that I canceled my drink. My family drove 500 kilometers from my city to capital to pick me up, 20 people, and I didn't have the guts to tell them that I'm not coming. And that night, all these people asking me, "Where was my turning point?" And this was my turning point. I cried, started bawling, crying, and I fell down to my knees and I said, "I don't know what you call yourself. God, Jesus, Allah, Buddha, whatever your name is, either kill me or save me, because I can't do this anymore." And the next day, two of my friends, they came and picked me up, my last detox. And this time, I told myself, because I never impacted my son, my two son, and I said, I will do whatever it takes. So I joined the 12-step program. I started trauma counseling. I started meditating. I started exercising, and I started being in service to other people. The key was to be in service to other people. And so that's an even longer version, but that's basically what happened.
Well, Essie, you know, and you're right. We think about our kids, right? We never realize, we do realize what our decisions make. But when somebody is in, you know, what you're going through, and, you know, my oldest son who we lost last July, he was suffering just like you had with addiction to alcohol. And he was doing great. And he had had an argument with his girlfriend. And it was that one stop at the store. And then, unfortunately, he was at a bar that continued to serve him, probably shouldn't have served him. And then thank God, you know, he didn't take anybody else's life, but he lost his life driving and drinking and driving.
Oh,
and,
you know, sorry to hear that.
Thank you. So he didn't have that, you know, aha moment. You know, like you said, we reach that point where we just, you know, if you don't have a faith, it's just like some, whatever that being that's out there, just help me, right? We get to those points in our lives. And, you know, like what you were saying, that the drugs and the drinking, you know, you thought that was your solution, and you realized, you know, that you didn't like the skin you were in. Like that's, and I think what happens is, you know, people often say, oh, you can just stop. You know, it just bothers me when people say that about, you know, people that have an addiction. Because listen, even as a people pleaser, you know, I'm a recovering people pleaser addict. I would go help anybody do anything and anything short of committing a crime, right? And so we all have our own, whatever those addictions, those demons are that we have to work through and address. And like you said, since you were 6 months old, you've dealt with this. And then they're putting that in your bottle. So you were kind of already set up for that for your lifetime. And then to have that moment where something, somebody, whatever that faith is, stepped in and said, I'm going to send somebody for you and I'm going to get you help. And then you're doing what we talk about all the time too, about like serving others. You're right. I mean, we have to, like we said that earlier in the show, our story matters. It's, we have to, you know, I often say, you know, my son would say, why am I going through this? And I would say, I don't know the answers. You know, my son was adopted. We adopted when he was a month old. I feel like part of it was a separation anxiety, being separated from his birth mom. We all know that that's definitely, there's a genetic trait there. And then also, you know, he was a mixed race child. And so his biological mom was white and her whole family was white. We adopted him. We're all white. And she doesn't give him that. And he asked, like, I made sure that she stayed somewhat in his life until he was 18. And then when he turned 18, I said, it's up to you to foster this relationship. I would love for you guys to have a relationship, but he wants a relationship on truth. And he's very big about truth. And you are not truthfully giving him the facts about his birth dad. So if you want that relationship, you've got to step forward in the truth. For whatever reason, she would never, ever step forward in the truth. And it's, you know, it haunted him. That was his demon of not knowing, where's that other piece that I belong for? And no matter how he was, he would go for coaching, he'd go for counseling, but he still wanted that answer, right? Because he wanted to know where he came from. And, you know, and so him and I, you know, we were doing a book together, which I've been posting. It's called Beyond Skin Deep: Stories of Intercultural Adoption. So I'm carrying forward that book because I want to carry forward his story, right? Because like with you, our stories matter. And what you're doing is you're taking your story now and you're serving others with your story. Like you've done a TED Talk and you've got your book. But Essie, talk to us about how you are serving others. Talk to us about the programs you offer and what are some of the things you're seeing as people hear your story? Because I'm sure there's listeners on here going, oh my gosh, you know, starting at 6 months old and 14 was in, you know, in a war. And then to sit here and say, I can come and share my story. You know, and I know 10 years, it's every day is a work, you know. I have a friend that's 30 years recovered and he says every day it's still work. Right. And so tell us about your programs, how you're helping others, and what are some of the things that bring you joy when you work with the others you work with?
Of course. See, we live, we have this perception that life should be easy. I believe, and many other mentors, they talk about this, that yes, you know what, the biggest things that I myself included, had to learn. I had to stop being a victim. Because one of the things that my whole life, I felt like a victim. I'm not, you know, oh, look at me. I was born in a dysfunctional family. I was in a poor me. Guess what happened? When I am in that status mindset, there's no way I will take action. So that's the first thing I had to do. And then right now when I'm I do a lot of speaking. One of the biggest things that I'm emphasizing is being resilience. Resiliency is something that, you know what, look at us. Like, I live in the most beautiful city in the world called Vancouver, Canada. I've been all over the world. I've been in US, Europe, everywhere. And here's the thing. We are so blessed. One of the biggest things that we got is, like, we have this mindset, it's like a tunnel vision. And that's all we see. We are like in North America, majority of us, we have no idea the way that other people live in and have a bigger. One of the biggest honor and pleasure for me when I'm working with other people is when I see them and the pain and the suffering, and then I watch them. They haven't talked to their family, for example, for a while, or their need. We all have everything inside us. We just have. See, I had this quote. I have all the answer in my heart. I just have to ask the right question. And the right question that I ask some people that I work with, we all have a sensitive trigger that motivate us. Some of the people that I work with, they have kids that, you know, they're 5, 6, 7, and I own daughter, son, and I would ask them this. Do you want to watch your children go to a school, graduate, watch their graduation? Do you want them to, do you want to walk them through the aisle to get married? And the answer is yes. And I would say something like, the way you're living and the way you're behaving, it's not going to happen. And that would trigger them, some people, to take action, because majority of most, like all of us, we love our kids. So we need some motivation, and it's a great thing. But after a while, the motivation will phase away. So we need to have some inspiration to pull us into more action. And that's one of the way that I got help, and I worked with other people. And I'm in 12 steps, and there are a lot of work that I do. It's just for free. But I'm starting a coaching program that helps people to how to get more resilience, how to get motivated, because we already have that. And the biggest things, I ask every time that I do an interview, when I talk to someone who's not really in a mental state, I would ask them, and on a spot, tell me 5 things that you're grateful for. And then something happened, and I experienced it time after time. After they said these 5 things, I see a shift in their physiology. I see a shift in the way that they, it's like, and that's magic. So that's something that I work with.
So I'm going to talk about that, the gratefulness thing you said, because you're right. We have to stop being a victim. We play that. So we it's easy to fall into being a victim, because that's easy to say, oh, this is why I am, right? This is because of this happened to me. But when we can step in and come out of that tunnel vision, like you said, of being a victim, and we can really look, like, I, you know, one of the things, like when my husband and I have traveled, we were able to travel to 2 different countries with our kids when they were younger. We went to, on a cruise, and one of the places we went to was Rotan. And we said, we got off and, you know, we're like, we don't want to be the tourists. We want to take our kids to see, you know, how we want them to take them to see some of the fun stuff. But we want them to see how people live in other countries, right? So it's always important. And I just did this last month when I went on a cruise in, to the Caribbean. We went to Nassau, and our taxi driver did the same thing. We told the taxi driver when the kids were younger, take us into the city where you live. Our kids see? Because one of the things and I remember our boys were, not quite middle school. They're both, I think one was middle, one was elementary. And they asked the translator, do the kids have Xbox here, right? And the lady looked at the kids and she looked at me, I go, answer honestly. And she said, we barely have shoes here, And the faces of our kids, wow, they don't have Xbox here. And I'm like, see, because we always talk about taking care of your things because not everybody has the opportunity to have the things that you have and stuff. And so when we went in to go shopping, it was really cool to watch our kids. We went into the grocery store, the local grocery store, and to watch them look around and see the people walking without the shoes on and things like that. And they were so grateful to come home and be like, and it was a different attitude when they were coming home and sharing their things then, And then I remember that we went to Italy one time. We went to Italy and we had a stopover in Madrid. And some of the things they saw in Madrid, too, it was very eye-opening for them, And so we forget how the rest of the world, it's like we talked at the beginning of the show, the things that are happening. I want to be aware of what's happening because I want to remember how much gratefulness I have for what I have. You talk about the gratefulness, but also remember that how can I give to others that don't have the fortune I have? Last year when we lost our son, we have a local nonprofit here. It's called the Angel Foundation. My husband and I have donated to it for a long time, never, ever expecting that we would need their help, right? And so they actually stepped in and helped us with a fundraiser to help with some of the services for our son. And, that gratefulness to be like, wow, I was able, all these years of giving, I was able to receive and I was humbled by it, right? But it reminded me it's okay to also to receive help, right? And I think that's so powerful. And, it's funny, Etsy, you said about you asked them, tell me five things they're grateful. That's one of the first things that I love to do when I work with clients too, is I ask them, give me 10 things that bring you joy. Tell me 10 things that bring you joy. And why does it bring you joy? Don't just tell me because I woke up this morning. I want to know, why are you happy you woke up this morning, right? And then I love to make them work too about, tell me 10 things that you have to stop doing. You're not to-do list, right? Because our self-care is so important that if we want to do the things that bring us joy, we got to stop the negative talk, stop the victim, I'm a victim. Mm-hmm. We have to stop some of that chatter. And we have to stop hanging around with people who say we're not worthy about, oh, you shouldn't do that because that's never going to work. And things like that, and as we walk through that and I take them on, I call it our Shiro method. We take them on that roadmap to becoming, like you're teaching and coaching, resilient and becoming okay to understand that I can tell you, Etsy, no. And it's a sentence, and it's okay to say no because I'm saying yes to myself, right? So it's so powerful that when we can step in and like you said, I saw for those that are listening and can't see, Etsy's face lit up when he talked about how when they talk about what they're grateful for, his face just lit up, and I understand that because as a coach, I love to see people walk into what they were brought here for. No matter what your whatever your faith is that you're listening to us, I truly believe we've brought into this world. We're given talents. We go through things that, like what you shared, Etsy, some of the things you've gone through in your life are so traumatic. We go through those things, but we have to do something with that story. Because when we don't, we cheat ourselves, but then we're cheating others that are around us as well. So I want to thank you for sharing your story. I want to thank you for being on here and for being brave too, to share your story. Not a lot of people would not be have the bravery you do and have in sharing your story. So I appreciate that.
Appreciate it. Thank you. It is important to also to mention that, those childhood trauma we have to work with. People don't know anything about the way sometimes we act as adults because it's about abandonment issues. It's about, not having any boundary, people pleasing. Of course, when we were kids, because we've been denied and denied and denied, and then now we grow up and we want people to like us. And because our parents, I have these friends that they're talking about, for example, they just either man or woman, they like to hang around with, because they did not receive love or attention from their parents. Guess what happened? When we grow up, we wanted to please everybody because we want to be liked. And I, as you said, this is a journey. People talk to me and say, Essie, how did you, like, if they don't know anything about my story, and after my, even my friends that I didn't know, they didn't know when they read my book or they to watch my TED Talks, and I said, oh my God, how could you be so, I've been told you're so kind, loving, gentle, strong, confident. I said, you have no idea that it wasn't me. I was very low self-esteem for years. And my story is testament that human spirit, that we have the ability, and we have the ability as human to adapt and to change. And my story, your story, and thousands of other stories, just a testament that this is work. If I am really give myself a willingness and to take action, because all it comes to taking action, and not many people, unfortunately, want to take action.
That is so true. And I think that's exactly where we have to remind everybody to take action to, you know, it's important to take action in our life to help us overcome the trauma we've had in our life, and also to step into who we really are. That for some reason we want to be stuck in the victim mode, and it's okay to say, I don't want to do that anymore. I want to step into who I'm meant to be. And so I'm glad, Essie, I'm glad you're out there sharing your story. I'm very blessed that you were able to be on our show today. Now, I know we're going to put in the show notes, but can you let everybody know how they can connect with you?
Of course, they can connect me through my website, donotgiveupnow.com, or Resiliency Talks, resiliencytalks.com, anything. And I'd be more than happy to be in service. Anybody, anything I can do. Yeah.
Awesome. We're going to put that in the show notes. Okay. So now everybody's listening. If you listen to our show, you know, we have our Better Questions, Better Life cards, and I don't get any feedback. So if you guys want to go betterquestionsbetterlife.com, these are amazing cards. I journal with them. I just make copies of them. Sometimes I do a thing on TikTok with them as well. So Essie's going to tell me when to stop, and we're going to ask him his question. So here we go, Essie. Tell me when to stop.
Stop.
All right. So Essie, your question is, how am I expanding my influence? How are you expanding your influence?
By being authentic and being myself and being vulnerable. Being vulnerable, and as you said, to share not just the wins, but share my struggles. Share my struggles and be humble about it.
Well, I'm so appreciative you shared your struggles and your story with us today. And for those that are listening, make sure you like us on our YouTube channel. And everything is, of course, under Conversations with Pearl. Make sure you share this. And if you're listening on a radio show, we're so appreciative of all our listeners. And I just want to remind everybody that this October was my birthday. October 20th was my birthday. And my birthday month is open house at our Shiro League. So if you're interested in joining and stopping in for a free visit to our membership only group coaching, it's a free invite. Just email me hello@wsliving.com. hello@wsliving.com. Put the title in Shiro and I'll get you the link. We meet every Sunday evening from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern time. It's a great way to end your week. It's a beautiful way to start your week, all around self-care and putting yourself first. And in the meantime, I want to remind all of you that as you come into this world, we do come in as a little rough oyster on the outside. Our shell needs some help opening up. But as you open up, and as we shared today with Essie, when you start understanding that you're no longer a victim and inside is your beautiful pearl, I want you to go out today and I want you to find your inner pearl of greatness. And I hope you have an amazing day.